The state attorney general's office is appealing the 30-day prison sentence a former Billings teacher received for raping his 14-year-old student. District Judge G. Todd Baugh handed down the light sentence in late August, but scheduled a resentencing because he says it appears the original sentence may have been illegal. Attorney General Tim Fox says that may be the case, but the judge cannot simply change his sentence. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce tells us how more prison time was not ordered in the first place.
Records show teacher Stacy Rambold was in his late 40s when he began having sex with his 14-year-old student, Charisse Morales. Morales told her youth counselor about the relationship in 2008, who then notified authorities. The fallout from the relationship led her to commit suicide in 2010, before the case went to trial. Yellowstone County Attorney Scott Twido didn't work for the county then, but says prosecutors at the time were left in a bind. Morales was the complaining witness. She was the primary evidence. So the prosecution took a different route.
Obviously, it's a tough decision to make, but when you lose evidence, you sometimes have to try to figure out what's the best option for your community. I think that was the objective reasoning behind entering that agreement back in 2010.
The agreement he's talking about is called a pretrial diversion. In it, the prosecution told Rambold they would not pursue his case if he followed a sex offender treatment program for a few years. If he completed that, he would avoid prison. But there was a caveat.
That he would admit to one of the crimes that had been charged against him, and that admission then could be used against him if he violated the contractual agreement.
Twido says Rambold did admit to one of the crimes, and later, Rambold did violate the agreement. The former teacher was kicked completely out of his treatment program for violations like making unauthorized visits to family members' kids and not reporting a sexual relationship he did have with a woman.
And now, with that violation, we reinstituted prosecution.
Except this time, the prosecution was able to use Rambold's own admission to the rapes as evidence. Rambold chose to plead guilty, which leads us to Judge G. Todd Baugh's sentence of 15 years with all but 30 days suspended. County Attorney Scott Twido says that is not what the prosecution asked for.
We did advocate for a sentence of 20 years with 10 suspended, which we thought was a more appropriate recommendation.
Judge Baugh's month-long sentence is part of what has prompted a national outcry over this case, but it's also how Baugh approached it. The judge said the 14-year-old Morales was older than her chronological age and had as much control regarding the sexual relationship with Rambold as Rambold did. Baugh later apologized for the remarks, but that did not stop hundreds protesting outside the Yellowstone County Courthouse asking for his resignation. About 55,000 people from across the country have signed an online petition to that effect. Judge Baugh now says state law mandates a 2-year minimum sentence for Rambold's crimes. He has scheduled a resentencing hearing for Friday, but Attorney General Tim Fox says that is not how it works.
Judge Baugh doesn't now have the ability legally to reconsider the judgment, but there is an avenue to do that, and that's what we have done here at the Department of Justice.
The Attorney General's office has filed an appeal to the Montana Supreme Court. Fox says he does believe 30 days in prison for Stacy Rambold is in fact an illegal sentence below the mandatory minimum sentence of 2 years. The Supreme Court appeal could take months to resolve. I'm Dan Boyce reporting at the Capitol.
And in other news from around the state, a 16-year-old Great Falls boy who had reached a plea agreement in the rape of an 11-year-old girl jumped from the third floor of the Cascade County Courthouse, landing on the tile of the second floor. Great Falls Police Captain John Schaefer said Caleb Kubler jumped before his change of plea hearing scheduled for this morning. A representative with Benefis Health System said Kubler was in critical but stable condition. The Great Falls Tribune reports Kubler agreed to plead guilty in exchange for a sentence that could put him behind bars for 30 years. County Attorney John Parker said part of the courthouse was shut down for the investigation. Kubler was 15 at the time of the crime. He was initially charged in youth court, but prosecutors successfully petitioned to move the case to adult court.
State health officials say the first human case of West Nile virus for this year has been reported in Yellowstone County. Riverstone Health and the Department of Public Health and Human Services say the woman in her 50s was diagnosed last week in Billings. She did not require hospitalization and was expected to fully recover. Mosquitoes started testing positive for WNV in Montana in mid-July, and the first horse cases were reported in late August. Most people exposed to the virus experience no symptoms. Some develop a mild illness, while fewer than 1 in 150 may become severely infected with encephalitis or meningitis. In the United States this year, nearly 500 human cases of West Nile virus have been reported to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. 20 of those people have died.
A California man who fell about 35 feet down a crevasse in Glacier National Park was able to get back out and hike more than 2 miles back to a campground, then was airlifted out the next morning. Glacier Park spokeswoman Denise Germain says the 36-year-old man fell Tuesday evening while hiking by himself on Jackson Glacier. Other campers at the Gunsight Lake Backcountry Campground attended to him through the night. Early yesterday, three campers set out for help. They notified a backcountry ranger at about 8:50 a.m. The ranger called park dispatch, and the air ambulance from Kalispell arrived at the campground at about 10 a.m. Germain believed the man was taken to the hospital in Kalispell. She said his injuries were not believed to be life-threatening.
The Public Service Commission is moving forward with plans to change its rule requiring disclosure of salaries for top utility executives. The commission decided today to start work on a draft rule that allows utilities to ask that the information remain confidential. Commissioner said the new rule states that utility salary information is public, but gives utilities a way to assert a privacy interest if warranted. The current rule says the salaries cannot be treated as confidential information. Commissioners had voted earlier this year to start the processes of repealing the rule, which had originally been put in place by different commissioners in 2010. The regulatory agency last week backed off plans to scrap that rule amid criticism the public should have access to the salary information.
The Flathead Valley Community College becomes the first standalone two-year college in the state to offer a health clinic for students. Katrin Fry reports the clinic opened with the start of the fall semester in the new nursing building on the Kalispell campus.
So this is where we do your analysis. We've got
medical assistant Kathy Weller opens clean, freshly stocked cupboards to show the lab tests the clinic will conduct in office.
Up here we can do hemocult, the HCG, which is a pregnancy test, rapid strep, rapid flu, mono, and blood glucose. And also we can, we're a full lab as far as drawing blood.
Weller says these tests are the ones most common for the student population. Physician's assistant Shelley Naomi says she can treat patients for a range of ailments, from preventative care to the common cold and sexually transmitted disease testing.
We do plan on trying to do a flu shot clinic. We do keep flu shot here in the clinic as well, so patients can come in for that. As far as preventative health and woman exams or that kind of thing, we are able to do that here as well.
Weller says as a community college, the Flathead Valley Community College Student Health Clinic is providing services not just for traditional college students right out of high school, but students of all ages.
We've actually seen several patients over the age of 50 already. So, yeah, uninsured over 50 even too, which is cool.
Vice President of Administration and Finance with FVCC, Chuck Jensen, says the school has a lot of uninsured students and the clinic is filling a void.
So basically all the services in the clinic are free unless we have to send out a lab. You know, if they have to do some sort of blood work, the student will be charged for that, but you know, that'll be at a cost basis to do that.
Students taking 7 credits or more pay a $45 per semester fee to access the FVCC health clinic. Students taking 4 to 6 credits can opt into the services by paying the fee. In addition, an anonymous donation doles out $50,000 each year to the clinic over the next 5 years. Jensen says the fees plus the donation cover the costs and calls the clinic self-supporting. He says FVCC is the first standalone community college in the state to offer a health clinic. Other two-year colleges connected with the University of Montana or Montana State do offer health clinics through their 4-year counterparts. It's located near the main entrance of the new Rebecca Cheney Broussard Center for Nursing and Health Sciences. Jensen says the whole building is paid for without going to the taxpayers. The Broussard family donated $4 million in memory of Rebecca Broussard, herself a former nurse. The college raised an additional $1.5 million from the community. He says the health clinic was part of the original design.
As we looked at this building to be a nursing building and an allied health, it just became a real natural extension of that.
Naomi says nursing students may play a role in future flu clinics, but will not be part of the general health care services. FECC modeled its clinic after Montana State University Billings, which contracts with the local hospital for staffing. Both Naomi and Weller are part of Kalispell Regional Medical Center, as is Naomi's supervising physician, Mona Cuthbert. The FECC Student Health Clinic is open Mondays and Wednesdays from 9 to 1 and Thursdays from 11 to 3. Katrin Fry reporting from the Flathead.
Seven protesters arrested during a rally calling for the ouster of the Blackfeet Tribal Business Council have been released. The arrest came during Tuesday's attempted takeover of the council by opponents of Tribal Chairman Willie Sharp Jr. The Flathead Beacon reports the seven people released today face charges including assaulting police officers and obstructing justice. Political infighting among Blackfeet leaders has seen five council members suspended or ousted since last summer, along with dozens of tribal authorities. Sharp's administration has been ruling during that time on an emergency declaration. The opposition group says tribal elders last month ordered Sharp and his allies replaced with an interim council that would remain in place until an election is held.
Five members of a northern Montana Hutterite colony and the colony itself have reached plea agreements in a case involving the illegal possession of grizzly bears. The Great Falls Tribune reports the men each agreed to plead guilty to a federal misdemeanor count of possessing a grizzly bear, a threatened species. The agreements, filed Tuesday, call for the men to pay a total of $19,000 in restitution to the state. The Ponderay Hutterite colony, as a corporation, has agreed to plead guilty to possessing a sow and yearling grizzly. The U.S. Attorney's Office says it won't recommend more than a $20,000 fine. Colony attorney Max Smith says he will argue for lower fines during a hearing on the plea agreement. The hearing has not been scheduled yet. The men were not charged with killing the bears.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has given $170,000 to the Montana Livestock Board in part to pay for projects that reduce conflicts between wolves and livestock producers. Department of Livestock spokesman Steve Merritt says $100,000 of federal grant will be spent on non-lethal efforts to deter wolf attacks. That includes measures such as carcass removal, range riders, guard dogs, and flagging on livestock fences. The remainder of the grant money will compensate livestock owners for verified wolf damage claims. The federal money is in addition to the $200,000 the state legislature devoted to predator damage compensation over the next 2 years. Merritt says that beginning October 1st, the Livestock Board will also pay for grizzly bear damage claims.
The University of Montana's legal counsel presented a campus lecture today examining Title IX's impact in America over the last four decades. Title IX states in part, quote, "No person in the United States shall, on the basis of sex, be excluded from participation in, be denied the benefits of, or be subjected to discrimination under any education program or activity receiving federal financial assistance," end quote. The provisions had profound impacts on high school and collegiate athletic programs. In this evening's feature interview with Edward O'Brien, Lucy France discusses those impacts. She explains Title IX was created to address disparity against women.
There are key areas of Title IX, and one certainly was athletics and the regulations. There are specific set of regulations that govern athletics, making sure that there is equal access and equal opportunity, equal facilities, things like that. Certainly access to higher education was an issue, and access to education. You know, we still have issues in the STEM fields, also in employment. When we look at the numbers of women in engineering, women in science, those are huge areas, and Title IX covers those. The learning environment, there are cases talking about overcoming gender stereotypes for things like that, standardized testing, and certainly sexual harassment is an issue.
And Title IX's underpinnings really come from the Civil Rights Act, which in itself kind of lit a fire under the women's rights movement.
That's correct. The Civil Rights Act of 1964, Title IX was an amendment to that, the education amendments. And so Title IX specifically applies to institutions that receive federal financial assistance. their other titles, for example, Title VII in 1964, did include a provision to prevent sex discrimination.
Yeah, we hear about Title IX. We don't hear about the other titles so much.
Yeah. Well, in my world, I worked a lot in Title VII in terms of employment discrimination. So that's something that has evolved and taken sort of a different path.
What do you say to those who believe Title IX wrecks programs like men's basketball in favor of women's field hockey? You know, and I've just made that example up. Do they have a point or not?
I don't think so, and I think the courts have held not. It's really to equal the playing field. It's not intended, and I believe there's guidance, although some schools have eliminated a men's football program in some other circuits, and I'm familiar with those cases. But the intent, and certainly the way we do it here at the university, is to equal the playing field in terms of making sure that we provide equal opportunities for both men and women if there's an interest. So some statistics that were actually pulled together by one of the wonderful law students who works in our office sometimes. In 1976, in the Montreal Olympics, U.S. women's teams brought back 18 medals. In 2012, in London, U.S. women's teams brought back 61 medals. In 1976, the U.S. women won 3 gold medals. In London in 2012, the U.S. women brought back 31 gold medals. I think that's a huge success. It's my personal opinion. I think we can attribute a lot of that to the opportunities that women have had all through the system in the United States after Title IX.
I wonder if the impacts of that go beyond sport, if that translates somehow into economic success, personal success stories.
And I can just speculate because I'm certainly not an expert in that. But anecdotally, I think that that's the case, certainly in terms of what I've read. If girls have the same opportunities in K-12, in sports, in testing procedures, in not being stereotyped and not being told that they can't do math, there's going to be a higher rate of success that translates through grades to employment.
We've talked a lot about sports. We generally do when it comes to Title IX. How has it affected students otherwise, other aspects of their education, pregnant students, single parents, things like that?
There are provisions in Title IX and certainly in the guidance that make sure that, again, educational institutions receiving federal funding are not discriminating. It used to be, and that was a problem, and as you mentioned, K-12 also, certainly in high schools where pregnant students needed to drop out, and that's not permitted under Title IX. Same at the university. There can't be discrimination because somebody's pregnant, because somebody's a single mother or father, for that matter.
And this brings us to the Department of Justice and the Office of Civil Rights investigation, and that agreement includes many provisions here at the University of Montana.
Correct. And I can go back. The Department of Education Office for Civil Rights, beginning in 1997, actually provided guidance to institutions that receive federal funding, specifically with regard to sexual harassment and how the regulations applied. And those were amended in 2001, that guidance. And then there were two Supreme Court cases where students filed lawsuits against school boards, and this is in K-12 schools, where they were alleging that they were sexually harassed. The first one, the Gebser case, was by a teacher, and then the Davis case was a peer-on-peer sexual harassment. And the Supreme Court established legal standards for receiving monetary damages. The Department of Education, in the 2001 guidance, in response to that, clarified that institutions receiving federal funds have an obligation to follow the regulations, which are intended to proactively make sure that institutions are responding to allegations of sexual harassment amongst peers and making sure that the educational environment doesn't become hostile, and clarified that we don't need to meet the damage standards for somebody to receive monetary damages. And then, and this goes to your question, and I'm sorry, it's a long answer. So then in 2011, the Dear Colleague letter came out. That was additional guidance from the Department of Education Office for Civil Rights. And that Dear Colleague letter addressed sexual violence on campuses. And what our agreement with the Department of Education and the Department of Justice, if you look at our agreement and look at the guidance in the Dear Colleague letter, pretty much mirrors what the Dear Colleague letter said, the guidance that the Department of Education is providing to all institutions. If a school reasonably should know that there's student-on-student sexual harassment, it needs to take proactive steps, immediately investigate the situation, conduct a fair and impartial investigation. It clarified that institutions need to be using a preponderance of the evidence standard, the lowest standard of proof in investigating the situations, because it's a form of discrimination. Do this in a reasonably prompt time frame. Make sure that institutions have clear policies and procedures, and then provide notice to students of how to access the grievance procedure and how to report situations in which they feel they've been harassed.
Other things, enhanced training, professional development for employees, the PETSA, as it's called, training for students as
Correct.
Well.
And the Dear Colleague letter, again, discusses those things, all the proactive things that we should be doing to make sure that we're proactively making sure that we provide an equal educational opportunity for everybody. In the Dear Colleague letter, the Department of Education started with some statistics, and I can quote some of the language, some of the prefatory language. The statistics on sexual violence are both deeply troubling and a call for action to the nation. A report prepared for the National Institute of Justice found that about 1 in 5 women are victims of completed or attempted sexual assault while in college. The report also found that approximately 6.1% of males were victims of completed or attempted sexual assault during college. And that's what really prompted the Department of Education to provide this guidance to say, institutions, you need to be proactively addressing these issues.
And as you know, Ms. France, there are people who wonder if UM is creating a new definition of sexual harassment, a new definition that goes too far, unconstitutionally far, to really show that UM is trying to satisfy Title IX requirements. Do they have a point, do you think, or not?
No, I don't believe so. We're not creating any new definition. The policies that we are adopting encourage people to report concerns they have, and then that goes to a trained Title IX coordinator or a trained investigator to look to see whether that constitutes a policy violation, which certainly has to meet the definition of one of the definitions of sexual harassment that's consistent with the law as it's evolved through regulations as well as court cases.
Mm. When do you think we'll start to see the payoff from all this effort to improve the situation, or is there any way to know that?
There is, and actually part of the agreement requires that we monitor and we look and we track cases and we look to see whether, and then do climate surveys to look to see whether students are more aware of how to report. And it's a little counterintuitive, but if we receive more reports, I think we're seeing a success. Then more students are coming forward and saying, this is conduct that needs to be stopped, and then we can take efforts as an institution to address those problems.
DOJ referred to Montana as a blueprint for reform on this issue. And your office made a statement that's posted on the UM website. I don't know if taking umbrage is the right way to phrase it, but it says, I hear, quote, the university isn't interested in being a blueprint for any group's agenda. What did you mean by that?
I think the University of Montana wants to comply with the law, make sure that we provide an educational environment where everybody can thrive, males, females, non-traditional students, traditional students, you know, every gender and sexual orientation. And I think lots of institutions are looking to do that as well. I don't know that we need to be held out as anything but doing that. These are complicated issues and really difficult issues. And if there was one way to do it, we would be doing that. We would have done it a long time ago. Yeah. We're figuring out what works best for our students and our campus community.
What do you think the biggest challenge is that lies ahead for Title IX, not just here at the University of Montana, but nationally?
That's a good question. I think there are lots of challenges, and it takes work. I mean, when we look at statistics, we look at pay inequity. When we look at the statistics in terms of the STEM fields, the science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, there are still challenges to make sure when a lot of the jobs are in those fields that we are educating women at the same rate as men to take those jobs that are available. So those sorts of challenges. I think we certainly have challenges in the sexual harassment realm that we just discussed. I think we're taking strides to move forward. I hope so.
UM Legal Counsel Lucy France, thanks a lot for coming in.
You're welcome.
And in tonight's weather forecast for west of the Divide, tonight expect mostly cloudy skies with scattered rain showers and a chance of thunderstorms. Some thunderstorms may produce gusty winds and heavy rainfall. Lows will be in the 50s. Tomorrow will be mostly cloudy with a chance of rain showers and a slight chance of thunderstorms. Some thunderstorms may produce gusty winds and small hail with highs in the 70s to lower 80s. For central Montana, tonight calls for mostly cloudy skies and becoming partly cloudy. Scattered showers and thunderstorms are expected, and some may produce gusty winds, small hail, and heavy rainfall. Lows will be around 50 to 60 degrees. Tomorrow, expect partly cloudy skies with a chance of showers and thunderstorms. Some thunderstorms may produce gusty winds, small hail, and heavy rainfall. Highs will be around 80 to 90 degrees. And for southwest Montana, tonight will be partly cloudy with scattered rain showers and thunderstorms. Some thunderstorms may produce gusty winds, small hail, and heavy rainfall. Lows will be around 45 to 55 degrees. Tomorrow calls for partly cloudy skies with a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms. Some thunderstorms may produce gusty winds, small hail, and heavy rainfall. Highs will be around 75 to 85 degrees. And now for the editorial comments of Kit Fisher.
As Montana's hunting season slowly unfolds over the next couple months, it's hard to fully imagine the changes and successes in wildlife management that put us where we are today. We recognize the value of wildlife in the state, and we decided to make changes that would ensure future generations could enjoy the bounty of wildlife that we have today. Montana's elk herds have grown from 15,000 to 150,000. Bighorn sheep have made a tremendous comeback, as well as our whitetail and mule deer populations. But these changes didn't happen overnight or by mistake. Small, incremental changes in policy and public attitudes towards wildlife conservation have resulted in the significant achievements we can tout today. Most people scoff at this. They think sweeping actions are necessary to achieve significant results. But in reality, it's the cumulative impact of many small actions that ultimately create the most change. Take the case of Yellowstone's bison. In 2002, National Wildlife Federation started its Adopt an Acre program, designed to resolve conflicts between wildlife and livestock on public lands. The concept was simple, albeit revolutionary. We would pay ranchers a fair price in exchange for their agreement not to graze livestock in areas with long-term, irresolvable wildlife conflicts. This project doesn't involve lawsuits, and we're not interested in endless debate. It's strictly a market approach where ranchers can say no if the agreement doesn't work for them. One of our initial focal points was Yellowstone bison. At that time, during harsh winters when bison tried to leave the high elevation habitat of the park, they were greeted at the boundary by government officials who either rounded them up and killed them or tried to haze them back into the park. In some winters, more than 1,000 bison were killed. It was plain that bison needed winter habitat outside the park. Yet their migratory urge was being denied because ranchers feared that bison might pass the bovine disease brucellosis to their cattle. In 2003, NWF supporters donated $110,000, which allowed us to retire the Horse Butte cattle allotment on the west side of the park. In 2008 and 10, we retired the Cache, Elridge, and Wapiti cattle allotments, also on the west side of the park. Our most significant effort to help bison came in 2009 when NWF and its supporters developed an agreement with the privately owned Royal Teton Ranch on the north side of the park to no longer graze livestock. This agreement, which cost over $1 million, allowed bison to migrate along the Yellowstone River to public lands north of the park. We followed this up in 2011 with retirement of the slip and slide grazing allotment, also north of the park, the last major cattle operation in the area. The consequence of these individual actions? Domestic livestock were essentially removed from the key bison wintering areas west and north of Yellowstone Park, and this was accomplished with little or no controversy, and it left agencies with little reason not to allow bison to roam outside the park. That set the stage for the final step. In July, Montana state agencies released a proposal to permit bison to reside on a year-round basis in significant areas both west and north of Yellowstone Park. While this proposal is strongly resisted by livestock interests, the fact that so little livestock is now found in these areas weighs heavily on the side of allowing bison to roam. That's why we need your support. For Montanans who have been following the drama of Yellowstone bison, this proposal represents the culmination of decades of hard work and collaboration. And for those who are just learning about Montana's rich wildlife heritage, no worries. There's still much to do, a little bit at a time. This is Kit Fisher with the National Wildlife Federation. Thanks for listening.
Kit Fisher is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition, and the views expressed do not necessarily represent those of the station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Connor Valentine.
And I'm Courtney Anderson. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.